Thank you, Vernon, and good morning. It's another beautiful surprise morning in Santa Barbara. I would also like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to tell you about some work that we've been doing in Zurich for the last somewhat over 2 years now. Do you hear any better now?
Barely.
Serious gremlin could work here, I don't know. Well, I'll shout. So in Zurich, my collaborators on this project are Carsten Hohnerkamp, who is a student who will be finishing next year, so he'll be looking for a postdoc as the Matthew Fisher student. And Manfred Saum, he did all the numerical work, and Manfred Saumhofer comes from more mathematical physics background, is an expert on RG theory, and in fact has written a book which recently came out on the RG theory for many body systems. And Nubo Furukawa, who started us with us on this project, is now back in Tokyo. So the problem I want to address is this, of course, anomalous phase diagram of the cuprate materials, but from a rather different point of view than Matthew Fisher yesterday, because I want to start from the overdoped side and try to answer the question, what's going to happen as we reduce the dopage? How does this Fermi-Landau type Fermi liquid that we believe we have essentially over here behave as we go across and reduce the doping? And what is the origin? How do we see this breakdown of Landau theory as we get to lower and lower doping? And of course, the idea has been around, proposed by many people, that this is due to some kind of quantum critical point, which is hidden somewhere around here, as I'll discuss in a minute, and that this is due to the proximity to some kind of order, such as anti-ferromagnetic or other stripes CDW have been proposed. Now, this idea that Fermi liquid theory can break down and you can have superconductivity at a quantum critical point associated with the suppression of some kind of order does work. I mean, this is, I believe, a correct idea. And there's experimental proof of it in the heavy fermion systems by these very nice studies by the Cambridge group of Gil Lontarich and Steve Julian. They, for example, have taken two heavy fermion cerium compounds and suppressed, they have very good samples, suppressed the anti-ferromagnetism, and around here you have rho versus T, which doesn't show T-squared laws, and you have superconductivity here at very low temperatures. But here we really have a finite temperature phase transition which is going to zero, and we have superconductivity just in this vicinity. And that's not really the same sort of phase diagram that we have in the cuprates, because in the cuprates, this line, we have some line here, which is not a phase transition, and we have going to zero. Now this phase diagram that I showed you is really just a sketch. And the much more accurate attempt to understand what the real phase diagram looks like has been done by John Lorem and his co-workers in Cambridge. And John was here, and I believe we'll talk more about it later in the week. But let me just show you his phase diagram, which comes mostly from thermodynamics. This is taken from a recent paper with John Tallon and John Cooper. And here, there is some clear and important differences. Namely, that if we look, let's look in here, this is taken from the 1-2-3 system, this is from the bismuth system, Bristow system, but as you reduce the whole concentration, there comes a critical concentration which shows up very clearly in the condensation energy associated with the coherent superconductivity, with the superconducting transition temperature. Initially, this condensation energy is rising, and then it has a break in slope at this point and starts to drop. Now, this transition, this critical point here, is occurring at a pool density which is larger than the maximum or the optimal doping condition, the maximum TC. And this onset of the drop in condensation energy is associated with the appearance of some kind of pseudo gap in the normal phase, as seen in the thermodynamics. For example, here, this is the jump in the specific heat at the phase transition. The red curve is this critical value here, and as you reduce the doping, TC continues to rise. The blue curve is the maximum value of TC. You see it has a dramatically smaller jump in the specific heat, and that then, as you go further, then TC goes back. So this phase transition, and as I said, John Laurent will discuss it much more, here this phase type of phase diagram is based essentially on thermodynamics by integrating up the specific heat to get the condensation energy of the superconducting transition. Now, what's the interpretation of that? Well, the interpretation that I would like to offer is something like this. For pool concentrations greater than this critical value, we really have the full Fermi surface involved in the superconductivity. And for this region of concentration, I believe spin fluctuation theory, which we've heard a lot about from David Pines and others over the years, should be applicable. And in fact, there's a nice paper last year in PhysRev by Philippe Monteau and Gil Lanzaric, Philippe is here, which shows that the condition of antiferromagnetic fluctuations in two dimensions is particularly favorable to get a high TC within the spin fluctuation theory. But then, as we reduce the concentration of holes below this critical value, something happens to the superconductivity. The superconducting transition temperature is losing condensation energy, the jump in the specific heat, it starts to drop dramatically. And one way of interpreting this is that in this concentration region, there is some kind of partial truncation of the Fermi surface, which is a part of this pairing. But it is the pairing is no longer involving a full Fermi surface, but some kind of partially truncated Fermi surface. So this then raises the question of whether a partial truncation of the Fermi surface is possible without a finite temperature trace transition or without a symmetry gradient. The reason I say without a finite temperature phase transition is that we have, for example, this compound 1,2,4, which is well known to be underdoped, which is in fact one of the people can make very good crystals of 1,2,4 because the oxygen stoichiometry is very well under control, and the thermodynamic measurements show no phase transition at finite temperature, just a continuous crossover. So therefore we can say that if this idea of Fermi surface truncation is occurring, we must look for a way in which it can occur without any obvious symmetry breaking, without a phase transition. So what is the answer? The answer that I'm going to argue here today is that this can occur. I'm going to start from examples in ladder systems, but I know this is a controversial subject, and I hope I'm not misquoting Bob when I say that he said no in Houston. I'm not too much worried about misquoting Bob because I know he won't hesitate to correct me. But I believe you were arguing that you needed some kind of symmetry breaking, perhaps some kind of hidden symmetry breaking to truncate the Fermi surface. And so the question, on the other hand, I will try to argue that maybe this is possible without such symmetry breaking. So let me begin by discussing the situation in toy models that we can analyze completely and understand well, namely ladder systems. And these ladder systems are one reason that we can understand them so well is they are one-dimensional systems, and we can treat them either in weak coupling, where analytic methods can be used, or in strong coupling in TJ models where with more numerical methods. And the results are equivalent. We have a continuous crossover between weak and strong coupling. But then we look at the results in weak coupling, where more analytic approaches are possible. So let's start with the simplest ladder, which is the two-chain ladder. There's two legs or two chains. The Fermi surface in this case, if we're starting with weak coupling, we start with the Fermi surface, consists of two bands crossing the Fermi surface. So in that sense, it's a large Fermi surface. And then we have to introduce scattering processes at the Fermi surface. And as always in a one-dimensional system, these will, by the perturbation theory, there will be a series of logarithmic divergences which can be summed within an ORG theory. Now, when we look at this problem, there is, of course, a special filling, which is half filling here, half filling or one electron per site. At that point, these two Fermi wave vectors add up to exactly pi, or one half of the free one zone vector, and one half of the Bragg vector. And so therefore, at that point, additional elastic scattering processes are allowed at the Fermi energy. Namely, we could take, for example, a pair of electrons here and scatter them back to here. The momentum change would be 2 pi, but that's a Bragg vector, so that process is allowed. So when one writes down the various coupling constants, and this has been studied by a number of people, particularly in a very elegant paper by Leon Balance and Matthew Fisher, what one finds is that there are many coupling constants, and here, for this is, in, one can write them in terms of right moving and left moving currents and spin currents, and the scattering processes between them. And then there are additional terms, which are these umklapp terms, which are allowed at exactly half filling as elastic processes at the Fermi energy. And they involve scattering, for example, two particles from the right to the left, parts of the Fermi surface, as I illustrated earlier. Now, when one does then the one loop ORG calculation, then essentially all of these coupling constants flow to a strong coupling fixed point, which therefore in this electron notation is more difficult to analyze because you have many coupling constants diverging together. But one feature that one should note that's important, I believe, is that when we add in these umklapp processes at exactly half filling, the energy scale of this artificial, if you like, or this divergence in the one loop is enhanced. That means that the umklapp processes reinforce the pairing processes that are coming from the backward and forward scattering and enhance the energy scale. So they are not competitive processes in that sense, they are reinforcing processes because the energy scale of the divergence is enhanced by these umklapp terms. Now the ground state that one gets is a state at exactly half filling with a spin and a charge gap. And these charge gaps come directly from these umklapp processes. So we have generated a Mott insulator, if you like. It's an insulator which is exactly equivalent to when we go to the strong coupling limit to a form of RBD condensate. It's an insulator with a charge gap and a spin gap. And this charge gap comes about through these three extra umklapp coupling constants that we have exactly one electron per site. Away from that, we only have 8 coupling constants in the complete equation. Now, if we look at this from above, and again within this one loop ORG, what we see is that this RBD condensate is signaled by a divergence of the D wave pairing and of the uniform of the pi pi susceptibility, the anti ferromagnetic susceptibility. And both have the same exponent, and both are the strongest diverging susceptibilities as you come down in the normal phase. So the onset of this RBD state is characterized by the the divergence of both of these, simultaneous divergence of both of these quantities. There's also hints in the Orgy equations above, in terms of the compressibility and the uniform susceptibility scaling to zero at these points, there is hints for the onset of the spin and charge gap. But the spin and charge gap is really only, can be only, of course, analyzed by using a strong coupling theory at low energies, and this can be done in one dimension via bosonization, and one finds that the umlaut terms give rise to this term which pins the displacement, the total charge displacement variable, and is the origin of the Mott charge gap. So here in this one-dimensional system, we have this feature which we will not have in higher dimensions, namely that for laboratory weak repulsive interactions, we will get Mott physics of half filling, and this we see the origin of it in terms of the strong umlaut scattering. And even away from, if you're close to, but not at half fillings, to get the description in terms of a hardcore boson gas of whole pairs, which works universally at, for any weak or strong coupling, as emphasized by Schultz, then this, to get this description, we need to include these umlaut processes. So away from half filling, of course, we no longer have a charge gap, we have just a spin gap, but the Hamiltonian for the charge sector consists of this umlaut term, and this doping introduces this term proportional to the gradient of this displacement vector, and so this Hamiltonian loop is that for solitons in the charge sector carrying the charge QV, and these solitons map then to the solute gas of hardcore bosons. So that's the simple case of the two-leg ladder. What happens if we increase the number of legs? How does this Mott transition occur as we do some doping away from half filling? At this point, let's look at the next largest, which is a three-leg ladder. At this point, there are three bands crossing the Fermi surface, which can be divided into two with even parity and one with odd parity with respect to reflection about the central leg. And even parity bands have half-filling gaps in charge and spin. They behave just like the two-leg ladder, whereas the odd parity is gapless in the spin degrees of freedom, just like a Luttinger, a single-chain Luttinger liquid. And now when you dope, what you find is the holes enter here and not in here initially. And so that the Fermi surface in this case will be purely in this band. And there will, and for a knit up to a critical concentration, there will be no holes will enter here. And that's because this has a larger gap to inject a hole, simply because it has a charge and a spin gap because of the umlaut scattering between this pair of bands. And here is to demonstrate this for you. This is the results from Stephen White, who will be speaking after me, and Scott Scalapino from a couple of years ago. This is in the strong coupling limit. We had done in Zurich some results analysis using much smaller systems than with Langsaus, but this is with DM or G. And here you see the odd parity band. This is a system with four holes in 96 sites. And you see in the odd parity band, this is N of K, this is the Fermi surface of a Luttinger liquid, whereas the two even parity bands, we have no sign of any sort of Fermi surface. So the holes enter only here. So what we have then is some kind of a state where the doping does not occur uniformly in all bands, but because of the dependence of the charge gap on it as a function of the band index, there is a partial truncation of the Fermi surface, and part of the Fermi surface is gapped and is in the weakly doped system, is gapped, although I stress again, there is no, associated with this gap, there is no change in translational symmetry along the ladder. And similar results can be obtained for N-leg ladders in weak coupling if one makes the first takes the limit of the, first keeps the interaction strength finite and then considers the limit of small doping. So in that limit, you find again that the different channels or different parts, if you like, of the Fermi surface look different. Well, that's for these quasi-toy models. Now let's look at the more complicated problem of two dimensions. And here in two dimensions, we have to consider, of course, a Fermi surface now. And here we have in the cuprates a special condition. In the case of the strontium ruthenates, which are very highly two-dimensional, as was discussed yesterday, there we have a very good Fermi liquid. But as we heard yesterday, the Fermi surface there consists of three sheets, and each of these sheets is approximately two-thirds doped, namely that the electrons, the four electrons, distribute themselves more or less evenly in three bands. So no single band in that Fermi surface is near half-filling. And that is why I believe in that case we get Fermi liquid behavior. But here in the case of the cuprates, as we start to increase the electron density towards our filling, we have a situation where the band is now nearly half filling, and with this typical curvature, we start to cross a surface which we call the Umklapp surface, which is a surface where elastic Umklapp processes are allowed, namely from you can scatter from here to here, a pair here can scatter to here and conserve the momentum module of Bragg vector. So the question is now, in this case where the Umklapp processes will be taking place over regions of the Fermi surface but not simultaneously over the whole Fermi surface, will we get some kind of partial truncation? So that's the issue that I would like to try to address. Now, the first thing we had done a couple of years ago on this was to look at the more simplified model rather than the full two-dimensional model, where we looked at just these neighborhoods of the saddle points, arguing that they, with the high density of states, would be the dominant regions. And this, in fact, this model has a long history going back to the very earliest days of Huygensee, later on Montebello and Pavlov. And they, these equations that were studied were in fact originally written down by Peter and Montebello and Pavlov in 87. So if we included both the particle-particle channel and the particle-hole channel. Initially, Jaloszynski, for example, dropped the channel here, arguing that this one, because of the high divergent density of states, was dominant. But in this case, he concentrated on a weak coupling fixed point where the coupling constants flow to zero as in a Luttinger liquid, but motivated by the two-leg ladder, et cetera, we were looking for a strong coupling fixed point, and in fact adding in the particle-hole term tends to favor this sort of strong coupling fixed point where we flow through a D-wave pairing, but in addition have this forward scattering process is also diverging. And these forward scattering processes, we could show that under finite interaction strength, under certain conditions on the interaction strength, could actually lead to a compressibility, the system a tendency for incompressibility at these points or opening up the charge gap, although the underlying model would have the divergent density of states at these points. But I'd like rather to go on, I'll discuss some more recent work, which involves an attempt to really do the full two-dimensional problem by dividing up the Fermi surface into a set of patches, and typically we use 32 patches. Again, we are not the first to do this. Zanchi and Schulz were the first to take, and there's also a paper by Holbrook and Metzner in Fitzgerald. Zanchi and Schulz considered primarily the simplest model where the D prime term was neglected. So in this case, the two surfaces coincide exactly at half filling. That, we believe, is somewhat pathological or more difficult special case. And while Halbold and Metzner also looked mostly at that case, so they did consider some also the situation a bit with this finite D prime. But we kept a finite three primes and then divided up the Fermi surface into these patches, or if you like, into these lines. And so the integral over the two-dimensional integral is written as an integral along each line with and then summed over the number of lines. And the RG equations we used, they essentially a Wilson type RG flow, where higher and higher energy, higher or lower and lower energy regions from the Fermi surface are successively integrated out. And we start with initial conditions with Hubbard-like or structureless interactions. So the RG equations in this form here, the idea is that we keep the momentum dependence of these coupling constants, which in this case, of course, depend on three independent momenta, and this we parameterize in terms of these three patches. Each momenta is assigned to a patch, and so we keep this coupling constant as a function of all these three patch indices. Then on the right-hand side of the RG equations, we're in the one loop. We include all particle-particle intermediate states and plus the particle-hole channel. And so then we turn the crank and integrate up these equations and see what we get. So remember, we're looking only at a flow equation where we're watching the system evolve to lower and lower energy scales, or if you like, lower and lower temperatures, to see what types of interactions are divergent. Now, first, let me consider the case of a very low electron density. That's to say, where the density, actually, in this case, we just about have the Fermi surface touching the saddle point, so we could work with the region a bit below that. And the starting parameters, we took T prime, typical value of a third T, and we take a finite value of U. Now, this session is entitled Strongly Correlated, so this value of U probably doesn't qualify, so I apologize for being in the wrong session, but we would like to, we would of course like to take a larger value. We don't take this value because we consider this realistic, but we feel that this is maybe the largest value that we can reasonably take without getting ourselves into problems, since this is just a one-loop RG calculation. But we do want to have not an arbitrarily small value, but a finite value, because we want to look at instabilities. We're thinking about the strong correlating problem. We want to look at, try to see precursors for the transition to the Mott state. Well, let's look at, anyway, with this finite value, this moderate value of U. And here, this is now a snapshot where one of the outgoing K values is fixed at this point 1 here in the vicinity of the saddle point, and which are the two incoming, which become large as we lower the temperature. And we see that the large values lie along these lines. Typical value here is around 17.1 here. So that corresponds to incoming here. And then we have fixed one of the outgoing here. So that means we have forward scattering in the Cooper channel. We have an incoming pair like this, and we're having forward scattering of this pair, and this becomes strongly negative, as we would expect for a D wave. Whereas here, this is a situation where we have something like 25.9 or something like that. 25.9 is a pair like this. So in this case, we take this pair and turn it to this pair, and this is a strongly repulsive scatter. So this pattern that we see along these lines are exactly the pattern for a Cooper or a BCS pairing instability in the D-wave channel. And in fact, if we, in this low electron density or strongly overdoped region, if we follow then a number of these coupling constants, and we of course have an enormous number, this is just a few of them, you see that the most divergent ones are these D-wave Cooper. The divergent scale, the scale for this onset in this one loop RG is relatively quite low, and we're dominated by a D-wave Cooper type instability. So this, if you like, is a form of Cohn-Luttinger type instability that we are seeing through the D-wave channel. Now, on the other hand, if we go very close to half filling, the pattern of the diverging, strongly diverging coupling constant changes considerably, and we now have scattering up dominated, for example, out here. This is a point something like 25, 25, or something like that. So this is a pair up here. And again, we fix an outgoing one here at this point. So we have a pair here scattering to a pair here. So this is this Unklamp process. This is one of the, this is in my former notation, this was a G3 Unklamp process. So this, in this case, the dominant interactions that are growing as we come down in the energy scale are quite different and are dominated by Unklamp processes here at exactly as close to half filling. And when we look at these flows, again, we see that it's the three-type Unklamp processes at the saddle point which grow fastest, and while there is some hint of the Z-wave, they are less dominant than the Unklamp processes, and the scale is different now from the last curve, and the energy scale associated with the divergence has been considerably enhanced. So we have a stronger, larger energy scale and at this point. Now, if we go to an intermediate density where we, the Fermi surface has crossed beyond the saddle point, but because the dispersion is very flat in this region, we now have a large low-energy region around the saddle points to scatter from, then we have a mixture of these two. We have a situation where we have both this line appears in the phase diagram, but also these ones appear comparably. So we have a situation where we have, similar to what we found in the two-leg ladder, what you find in the two-leg ladder, that both types of divergences, Unklamp scatterings at the saddle point and D-wave Cooper-type scatterings are becoming equally strong. So we go to an intermediate range. The energy scale is now intermediate. It's larger than when we had a simple D-wave instability, but it is not as large as when we have this strongly Unklamp scattering very close to half filling. And so in these, what we find then is that this competition between the two shows up in the susceptibilities. Again, we are now going to compare the divergence coming from high energy scales and the anti-ferromagnetic susceptibility and the D-wave pairing. Strongly overdoped, the D-wave pairing dominates. Strongly underdoped, the Unklamp processes now have driven the magnetic susceptibility to be the dominant susceptibility, and then in between we have a region where these two are diverging in a similar fashion. So in this intermediate range, where the energy scale is intermediate, initially we have a very low energy scale, here we have the largest, and then we have an intermediate region here. So the then another thing that we can look at is the uniform susceptibilities, which for the two like that give us some hints of the properties of the strong coupling phase at low energy scales. So here, if we do this, do a calculation, now this calculation is a little more approximate because it's basically calculated in, if you like, an OPA scheme, but using on the given energy scale the coupling constants that we got from integrating the RG equation. So a lot in the high energy processes, particle-particle-particle transfers are all included. And here, we can also look locally around the Fermi surface. We can look at dKf, d mu. How does the Kf value change when we change the chemical potential locally? And here, in the, for the charge susceptibility, we see that towards the saddle and the saddle point region here, this drops dramatically, whereas away from it, it doesn't seem to. So this we would like to interpret as signs of the onset of the charge gap locally at this part of the D1 zone. Whereas then the spin susceptibility, we see a drop more or less at all parts of the D1 zone. So with these results then, we would interpret it in terms of I hesitate to call this a phase diagram, and it should be interpreted with caution because it's not a real phase diagram, but if we look at something like where our energy scale tracks as a function of our chemical potential or our density, then we see there is a critical region associated with a critical point associated with this a crossover here at this finite energy scale associated with the increasing Umlaut process, so that we have not just simple D wave, but we have this saddle point regime where coexisting D wave and antiferromagnetism, and finally over here we have what we call the approximate nesting regime, where it's dominated by antiferromagnetism. So this, and the energy scale continues to rise as we go across there. So, okay.
What is the red line?
Well, this red line is the energy scale of the one loop divergence in the one loop orgy. So there are signs that this Fermi surface is behaving non-uniformly, and the Mach physics, which we associate with the onset of particle-particle Umlaut scattering, does not occur uniformly over the Fermi surface, but initially appears in the vicinity of the saddle points, driven by the special form of the Fermi surface that we have in the blue wave. And this shows up also in the angular dependence. So we can do, again, this is a more approximate calculation of the self-energies, where we calculate the self-energy within this scheme here using the renormalized coupling constant vertices at these points, and then look at the angular dependence of the self-energy. And again, we look at the imaginary part. Now this is calculated on the imaginary axis at omega equal to zero. So you can think of it as the imaginary part at a finite temperature, approximately at the finite temperature at the scale that the temperature determined by the scale lambda. And then the regions to go around the Fermi surface, the regions, this scattering rate becomes anisotropic, and in the regions near the saddle points, where the Umlaut scattering becomes stronger and stronger, it actually increases as we reduce the energy scale. So even though we're integrating over less space here, the blow up of the coupling constant in this region here causes it to increase, whereas here it tends to decrease. So the conclusion then that we would like to, interpretation that we want to give of our G equation is that we have short range antiferromagnetic correlations and spin gap. A spin gap appearing together with strong B wave pairing correlations, and that the anomalies are associated with the formation of this, if you like, this RBD state or some kind of insulating spin liquid state, which sets in not uniformly over the Fermi surface, but sets in primarily, if it's driven by the Umlaut scattering, primarily near the saddle point. Now, I know many people are not happy with the idea of truncating a Fermi surface without changing the size of the Brillouin zone. And there are in the literature attempts to generalize or prove a Luttinger's theorem which do not rely on perturbation theory, because of course the original, any sort of perturbative approach, we can argue, since this is not perturbation theory, would not be applicable. And one set of approaches which has been taken in 1D and now later in 2D by Ashikawa involved applying twist operators. So this is, I'm changing my approach a bit and asking the question about what can we say about the volume of the Fermi surface. There's a very nice paper a few years ago where a non-perturbative approach to the Luttinger's theorem in 1D was made by Ramanaka, Ashikawa, and Affleck, and they used this Michell's math twist operator for fermion systems. And the point is to show that this twist operator is on the one hand equivalent to a translation in k-space of an amount at 2 pi over L. You translate essentially all k-vectors when you apply this twist operator. But on the other hand, it can be written in this form here, which involves only the local density. So this commutes with the interacting part of the Hamiltonian. And so you can use this fact to show that the twist operator, when it generates a state with a different different total momentum, you can show in 1D that it also can generate an orthogonal state, and therefore you can prove the existence of low-lying excitations with 2KF. Well, I see I'm running out of time here. If you generalize this to a ladder system, then the corresponding twist operator has to be applied to all simultaneously to all legs, all sides on a rung in the ladder. And this then gives you a total momentum, which now depends on the width of the ladder. And in fact, it gives you a condition on the sum of the 2KF boundaries. But this condition, this truncated state that I was talking about, for example, the three-leg ladder, is exactly satisfies this condition, because if you pair up two bands which are exactly half filled, then you get a total momentum of 2 pi or a Bragg total momentum, and this condition is always satisfied modulo a Bragg vector. And so I believe you can apply this condition also to the case of 2D, where there's recently been this paper by Ashikawa, which is on the neck, where he applies this twist operator to a two-dimensional Fermi surface, and the idea is that you can calculate the total momentum change, the total wave vector, when you apply this twist operator in this form here, in the form of the exponential of the local number operators, or you can think of it as a displacement of the Fermi surface, and if you assume a Fermi liquid, you can calculate the total momentum when you displace the Fermi surface. And if you equate these two, you get exactly the usual condition on the Fermi surface volume. But again, now in 2D, these are large vectors called the square root of the size of the system, and truncating the Fermi surface along the umlaut surface means that you subtract it. You can always subtracting Bragg wave vectors from these large wave vectors. So again, without, I believe you can, without any contradiction on this theorem, you can discuss the truncated Fermi surface. So I see that term understanding, so very fast.
The questions are already here.
Let's see. Boris.
Yes.
Something like what you have described is almost certainly happening. My question, actually I want to ask two in a row, but they're the same question, so let me ask both. The first is, would you please comment on the life of the possibility that the behavior describing is critical enough associated with some incipient phase transition? And associated with that, what's your best guess as to the zero temperature phase diagram of these materials?
Well, I don't have to guess it. I mean, I was arguing that John Lorem has determined it for us now. That in fact that there is a critical point which is essentially triggered by a critical density.
What is it? What is the phase transition?
I say the phase transition involves a change of the superconducting superfluid density, or if you like, it's not really, of course, a phase transition involving topology of the Fermi surface per se, because we're always in the superconducting state, which doesn't really have a Fermi surface, but it's a transition which involves just a change, in a certain sense, like a Lipschitz transition. It involves a change in the superfluid density.
Okay. Suppose we kill off the superconductivity with the field. What happens?
Well, okay, then I would argue that you would then have a change in the Fermi surface.
Yes.
Without symmetry breaking?
Yes.
Could you please write down what you mean?
I don't have I am not arguing that I have a theory of a strong coupling. This is an interpretation from these high energy flows. And what I'm saying is that what we see in the high energy flows is that In these regions of K-space around the Fermi surface, around the saddle points, the lifetimes become extremely short as we decrease because we have this very strong umflap scattering, and I believe that is the signal for the onset of a charge gap. What I am saying is that the Mach charge gap does not have to open up simultaneously across the whole Fermi surface. If you look at a model where you try to keep the full Fermi surface volume as you approach the Mach transition, that is the model that Bill Winkler and I discussed many years ago. And in that model, the only thing you can do is to make the effective mass diverge to kill the Fermi surface in the Mach state. But if you do that, that means M star is diverging. If M star diverges, that means gamma, the linear term, the specific heat is diverging. And that's what you see in helium. You know, when you put pressure on helium, M star goes shooting up, the linear term is specific heat. Here, you don't see that. What you see is, and John Lauren has many beautiful measurements on that, you see is that the linear term coefficient of the specific heat gamma is proportional to the whole density, not inverse to the whole density. And that is, I believe, an argument in support of some kind of Fermi surface segments or some kind of partial truncation of the Fermi surface.
Hello.
Got my black.
Okay.
Yeah. A comment and then a question. The comment is your very first slide, or almost your first slide, you handed over the overdone side to antichromagnetic spin fluctuations.
Yes.
As far as I know, there's no evidence whatsoever of antichromagnetism in that region. There's no evidence whatsoever that Fermi liquid theory applies in that region. And there's no evidence of a phase transition in the superconductor, and a true phase transition that would indicate that it's a different superconductor from what you have on the other side. And since you made both, there is a rapid change in the quantitative results, but it is still the same piece because there's a phase transition at that moment. Basically, you gave no evidence for this opinion. Therefore, why did you express the opinion?
Okay, I expressed the opinion because we started with simply a Hubbard model. We looked at the flow as we go down in the strongly overdoped region. If we stay away from umflap processes at the Fermi surface, then we flow essentially, what we find is, we always find we flow essentially to a Fermi liquid type state with some kind of Cohn-Lessinger instability. Well, I mean, we can't, with the G equations, we do not see any other divergences other than the divergences in the Cooper channel.
Well, if there's no phase transition, as all of us agree.
No, we don't.
All sensible people.
I believe that if you are away from the, if you're strictly away, well away, that the Fermi surface, that there will always be some kind of Cooper-type instability, as discussed by Cohn-Lessinger of the Fermi liquid in repulsive cases. And I would point out there's a whole literature in the mathematical
literature.
Well,
we all agree that that's the motivation for what happens there. What I'm saying is, why do you insist upon looking at this particular wrong detail approach to that?
Well, whether you say this is wrong or... I'm surprised by a lot of mathematical physicists in Zurich, but to tell me that this is, rigorous, there's some very careful... Okay, some very careful...
I had a question. The question is quite straightforward.
Yeah.
I admire this renormalization group approach, but in principle, that you have done, and I think it's probably even right, but in principle, couldn't you say that that's essentially a very sophisticated way of doing a simulation rather than a way of finding the actual states system and the important qualitative differences between the system and other systems.
But
I think what you're saying agrees with the best simulations that I've seen very, very well. But I think it is something that's in the
way. Well, I agree. I mean, it is not a description of the strong coupled faith that sets in below the divergence and the one before it. I quite agree with you there. We are not claiming. And what the interpretation, I wanted to distinguish the calculations I presented and the way I interpreted these results. I mean, I then offered you an interpretation, but this is an interpretation and not a derivation.
No, it's qualitatively the right interpretation, obviously. But it's not answering these other questions, like, is it a fairly liquid and why does it have a contrary dependence?
Can I make a suggestion that we continue it?
Yeah, well, we have a session scheduled on Friday morning where I'm determined. And
I will be able to have a few more questions. I think Boris has made a really, I think John Laurel has made a very good case. If you just look at that data that is on the graph, you see there's a sharp change in many, many thermodynamic quantities at doping of about 0.2. Now, this will mean you must, if these changes are sharp in thermodynamic quantities at zero temperature, there has to be a phase transition at zero temperature. There's just no ifs and buts about it. So I totally disagree with Phil on this. And the second, the point that you are making here, which I don't quite agree, is that you are thinking about this as a Lipschitz transition with no symmetry breaking, whereas what Bob and Chetan and Dirk Moore and I have been talking about is it's a symmetry breaking transition. That's where the disagreements are. But I think that there's no escape from the data, analysis of the data, that there is a phase transition at zero temperature at that point. I mean, if this is as sharp as what we have shown. The another point is that in some data, it does not look like the delta gamma, it looks like delta gamma is dropping, or superfluid density is dropping as a function of doping as you overdose. And that's not quite like Fermi-Liquid behavior. So there is some subtlety out there which we don't understand, but I think there is a sharp change.
There was a question here, please.
Yeah, go ahead. As you go in the cold dissipation, they increase from zero. How many critical points are there?
Well, I would argue that in a model where you don't worry about impurities, kind of an ideal model, such as other type model, that this will have a tail, the superconductivity will have a tail all the way out of Cohn-Luttons is like a tail. And this critical point here then would be the only one, well, not the only one, we're the first one, but of course there is another issue, which is what happens as we go further over here, and whether this RBB paired state is inherently unstable, always essentially inherently unstable to magnetic ordering as you go to very low doping. I suspect it is, but that's the second one. Yeah.
Next question, please, in the front row.
I want to comment on the following. If I read what you're saying correctly, it's essentially a loosely one recoupling theory, which in one dimension works quite well because I think we understand the kinematics of one dimension of the test series. And there is little difference between strong coupling and weak coupling there. It's a little clearer than it's called here. It's similar in spirit to things that a number of us have been doing or did a number of years ago in trying to derive optimization from this dimension. And it has the same level of quality in the sense that it applies to the same machine. Now, whether this applies to a strong coupling is a separate issue. And I think that's where the difficulty is in the design. Now, what you are showing essentially is the competition between superconductivity in the deep wave channel and an anti-ferromagnet filling. And what happens in the middle where the dye essentially all the sensitivity creates in the world is a complicated machine that this sort of recoupling approach cannot possibly address. But this is related to this question of what is the meaning of this line. And there are many interpretations of this transition. For instance, it could be well-established current ordering transition that this is
No. Many things I disagree because this is not a film that there is this line here, it is in John Orange's action, it's a characteristic energy of a pseudo gap in density tape. In the term, and when you look at temperature, there is no real space condition thermodynamically seen. So I don't understand how it can be charged orderly, because that would be symmetry breaking and should have a real Well, there are some tetragonal compounds. They're not all along the line.
Can I make a suggestion?
But anyway, that's enough.
Running okay. Over time, so that we can have a break. And we would like to thank you very much for your